Okay, hello, and welcome to the latest edition of Innovations in Education, eSchool News' podcast on the latest and greatest trends in ed tech. My name is Kevin Hogan. I am the content director for eSchool News, and I'm glad you found us. Well, they did it. After decades of threats by Republican administrations, the Department of Education was slashed and burned by executive order last week. And while the wreckage will be analyzed and fought over for weeks and months to come, there is still very little clarity of what will happen to the current programs and processes. That's why I appreciated this conversation with the Cato Institute's Neil McCluskey. He's the director of the Center for Educational Freedom on what he foresees as possible next steps. You might not like what he has to say, but you might be able to glean some insights into how things will operate going forward. Have a listen. Okay, Neil, thanks so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on.
And as I mentioned before we started recording, the hot topic, right? I mean, it's one of many, but one that I haven't been able to find, to be honest, want to talk about it in terms of folks in DC or folks from my traditional sources of information, you know, whether it be various nonprofits in the area, other folks. Just there seems to be just a confusion and just kind of an uncertainty about what's going to happen. And I know there haven't been anything, you know, as of our recording today, anything definitive in terms of Ms. McMahon or, you know, and putting things together. But maybe we can start by talking about where you see the current state of play is for the fate of the Department of Education. And if we're going to assume things progress into what seem to be the intentions for our readers and for our listeners, what should they be expecting next?
Right. So I have to agree with a lot of people that there's a lot of uncertainty here. So everything I say is going to be based on sort of what I've been able to gather by following this for a while. And I think that the proposal we're going to see from the administration in the form, I think, of an executive order is going to be one saying, I think, that the president believes he has the authority on his own to do a lot of hiring, firing. So you will continue to see what we've been seeing through DOGE and other approaches of saying, look, I think the Department of Education has too many employees and we're going to reduce that. Just as they've been saying lots of things in the federal government have too many employees. But it gets a lot more complicated when it comes to, well, what do you do with the various programs that the and laws that the Department of Education has been tasked with executing by Congress? Because Congress is the one who writes laws, creates programs. And I think what we're going to see is an effort to move most of those functions to other departments than the Department of Education. In part, that's because a lot of people have been talking about that. There's been one bill in the Senate so far that starts to get into how we handle the Department of Education. It used kind of the dismantling of moving things to other departments, as well as block granting some funds. It wasn't totally clear what would be block granted, what would be moved, but that sort of set the tone. And then when Linda McMahon was at her confirmation hearing, she talked a lot about she can't, you know, the president and the secretary don't have the authority to end really any programs or parts of the department or move them, but that she would be working with Congress and that it makes sense to move at least, you know, a lot of the parts to different places, not necessarily get rid of them, but move them. And in the last few days, she's been talking especially about, and the president, about the student aid functions that the department has. You think about Pell Grants, student loans, things like that. There's been a lot of, I think, maybe additional emphasis on moving those maybe to Treasury or the Small Business Administration. But that seems to be what we should expect, is some sort of plan or order to develop a plan to move the parts of the Department of Education to other departments.
Okay. So if I'm an administrator in a public school district that relies to a certain degree on Title I funding for their district, or also when you look at the idea of the IDEA funds, IDEA funds, will there be a disruption there from what you can perceive, or is this going to be just letterhead from a different office?
So a lot of that depends. I don't think anything will happen if it's just the president saying it. But if Congress does it and these things actually are moved, in theory, it would be totally seamless. It would say, we've seen 180 days. I think that's too short. Maybe it's 365 days or a full year between when the law is signed and when things have to move. But during that transition period, you would hope, and the expectation is, everything would be moved seamlessly. So when you shut off the lights at the Department of Education, you shut on some new lights at the Department of Health and Human Services, they're ready to go. And people who work with the various programs, including Title IX or IDEA, would just see a seamless transition. So that's ideally. I don't know that the federal government or even most organizations are capable of a seamless transition like that. Sure. We certainly haven't seen when the federal government has tried to make sizable changes that it's just kind of gone off like clockwork and nobody noticed. So I think there would probably be some probably temporary, maybe even minor disruptions in who you're talking to and how the information flows and money flows or working just in terms of the logistics of them, but that would probably be temporary.
How about when it comes to more of the big picture issues and maybe some of the topics that I've covered over the years, specifically from the Office of Education Technology, when you look at things like advancements in the past 10 years when it comes to digital equity, which was certainly one in terms of trying to ensure access to the internet to all students, especially from underserved communities or underserved districts during COVID, when we had gone into that great remote beta test of education and people trying to figure out and discovering, even district administrators themselves not realizing that within their own districts, there were a lot of students that didn't have access to the internet from home. A lot of those things, you know, kind of driven by the Department of Education, then led to an increase of those students actually having access. So those big picture things, blended learning is another one that was in effect during COVID that I know that there were programs put together by the department, which were soft and squishy, right? I mean, maybe there's no like particular data that comes from them saying this is maybe increasing literacy scores, but kids still have access to the internet. But also, I guess the other big picture one is when it comes to data. I mean, I think that is one of the things currently that the Department of Education did was to try to track data across districts and across states, of which you have 15,000 different school districts. Some are going to be better than others, right? And some are going to be more aggressive or even progressive when it comes to what they do with their students. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, are those things that you think should be left to the states or even individual districts versus some sort of overall umbrella that the federal government had?
Sure. When it comes to the federal government, the first thing we ask is, well, is it constitutional? Does the Constitution give the federal government authority to do these things in education? And the first thing we see, well, or don't see, is the word education in the Constitution. It's nowhere among the specific enumerated rights. So we start off with sort of an assumption, or at least I do, that the federal government shouldn't be involved in these things. And then I look at effectiveness and what if the federal government weren't involved? What we tend to see is people like to blame other people when things don't go well. So when you've got the federal government, it's easy for the states to say, well, the reason we dropped the ball, or the districts to say the reason we dropped the ball on being prepared for something like COVID or on covering sort of digital access or whatever they are saying the problem is, it's easy to say, well, the federal government should have done this or didn't do enough. Or if you're a district, you say the state didn't do enough. And that's a problem when there's no accountability. Each level blames another level. And the federal government, interestingly, has never actually said it's responsible for education. It set up a Department of Education and said, we're here, we kind of help with stuff, but constitutionally, legally, we can't actually control anything. So it makes a lot of promises and then doesn't follow through on them. And then the states and local districts can say, well, it's really the federal government's fault, or we need leadership from the federal government. That's something we saw a lot under COVID, with school districts saying, lead us, federal government. We can't make our own decisions. And I think it's actually better if you have much more clear accountability. It's either your district or your state. Get rid of the federal government. It's well-intentioned, but there's so many unintended consequences that go with that, it's problematic. And then one of my, I wouldn't say hobby horses, because I use a lot of federal data. And I, in a way, I like the data. And people who want to talk about the national education system may like the data. But on the flip side, it's really kind of poor. So I do a lot with, you know, how much are we spending per pupil? And I think the last time I checked, which was a few days ago, the federal government will give you spending data. I believe the most recent is from the 2020-2021 school year. It may be up to 2021-2022 right now, but we're in the 2024-2025 school year. And so the data is really old. I track private schools. The private school universe data is really old. Most of it's not useful then. So while I like the data, I'm not sure that the federal government even does a good job of that basic function of data collection, certainly not collecting it in a timely manner. So while a lot of these things sound good, I think we'd actually be better off if the federal government was not a player in this. And in particular, people couldn't say it was the federal government's fault when it wasn't their responsibility to begin with. It was the state or the school district. And then the other sort of thing that you can take as encouraging, I think, at the state level is, while the federal government was supposed to come in and do some compensatory funding, was originally its main job for low-income districts, not sure it did a good job, but in the states, you have, lots of states have lawsuits to compel the state to have equitable funding. And that's really the way to do it. That's much more concrete than kind of hoping that the federal government will keep pitching in some money when, again, it says, we're here, but we don't really have any responsibility in this area.
But so then do you see that the duties of, say, the data collection and that analysis going to a different department as well? How do you track the overall results of the nation as a whole?
For me, if I were setting it all up, and this is not what most people are aiming at, so we got to separate what I'd like from what I think is going to happen. But for me, I think that you could still have data collection at the state level, and there would be lots of private entities who would collect that data and use it on a national basis. In fact, you can go to the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown University, and they've much more quickly gathered together data on all sorts of things in education than the federal government has. Stanford has big data sets that you can use, and they're more accessible than what the federal government has. So I, even though I think data collection is one of the more innocuous things that the federal government does, I just don't think it does it that well, and it's a mistake to rely on them to do it. That said, I haven't seen any proposals that actually remove the federal government from that role. What I've typically seen is that the data collection should be done usually by the Census Bureau. Actually, they already collect a lot of education data, so it wouldn't even be necessarily a new thing they do. But they're already sort of a data collection entity, agency, and it would make more sense for them to do it, since, again, in many cases, they're already collecting data on education, than to keep it at a Department of Education.
How about with the other big squishy topic when it comes to, and I mentioned digital equity, and I can even just focus it on that idea of digital equity when it comes to the eSchool News. In reading some of your blog posts, you see some of that being connected to the civil rights responsibilities in a big picture and those being moved over to the Department of Justice. Describing that accurately?
You got it.
Yeah. So how would that mean in terms of, say, digital equity? And if I go back to the idea that, you know, every student should have some sort of access or the ability to have access to the internet in order to do their learning. I mean, kind of an essential part. Having indoor electricity or water.
Right. So civil rights enforcement is a legitimate job of the federal government, but it's enforcement against states and local governments, but in particular states that discriminate in their provision of things that they say are going to make available to everyone. So if again, this is what a lot of these equity lawsuits are about that we've seen in states across the country is, hey, state, you say you're going to provide an equitable education for everyone in the state and you're not providing it. And so, again, in many cases, states and the state justice systems are doing that. But the federal government does have a role to say, okay, states, you know, state of Montana. I don't know that they have a problem. We'll just pick them randomly. But state of Montana, it looks like, you know, you are underfunding your low-income districts, I don't know, by $2,000 a pupil or something, or you are clearly have inadequate access to the internet in your more rural districts versus your more urban. We think that that violates equal protection. And so if the federal government says that, then the federal government takes them to court and says, look, we are suing you to do what we think you should do. That means the federal government is taking an enforcement position, but not a provision position. There's nothing in the Constitution that says it's the federal government's job to provide it. It is their job to make sure that other governments don't discriminate in their provisions of things. Of course, there's a lot of law involved in there. You know, it has to be a particular class of students and things like that. But that's the role it should have, is as enforcer, not as supplier. And we should want much more emphasis on people in states saying to the states, you are responsible for this, and what you are doing is inequitable. It can also apply to districts, of course. I mean, if you have a big district, lots of schools, and they are inequitably providing things within the district, same thing should happen. It should start with state enforcement of equity or equality under the law. But if they don't do it, again, then the federal government can be involved. But it's not the federal government's job to pay for this. And I think I should always remember, and I never do, but in the background of all the things that we tell the federal government to spend money on, is that we have a almost $37 trillion deficit or debt. And so the federal government, while it seems to be able to print money, it can't print money forever. And so everything we ask it to pay for, we tend to ignore it doesn't actually have the money to do it. It's got to reach into many future generations and say, well, you're going to pay for this. And so that's a problem too. And we need to remember that. There are lots of great things, valuable things the federal government could pay for, but we've got to remember it's got limited resources just like everybody else.
Yeah. So, and I mentioned this earlier as well, just talking about the kind of the confusion and some despair involving with our readers and our listeners about what's going to happen next. And I know it's not under the umbrella of the Department of Education, but E-Rate is one of these federal government programs. And you talk about providers versus enforcers. I think has been identified amongst our community as one of the great successes of the federal government enabling the use of internet in schools. So, and you're going from 1996 when it was first introduced to where it's basically been a bipartisan agreement and it has been progressed year over year over year. Is that, and now there's a worry that that's going to go away too. I mean, that's kind of, it's kind of like part and parcel of the idea that, you know, Department of Education, what's next? Is it E-rate? Do you have thoughts of when it comes to regards to E-rate in general and that effect or that worry?
Yeah, so as you can imagine, I'm not a big fan of E-rate. Again, I don't think this is something the federal government should be involved in. I haven't focused on it a whole lot, in part because it's not part of the Department of Education, and that has been the focus. But I do follow a lot of education news, and I haven't seen anybody mention E-rate as something that they want to eliminate, at least not somebody in the Trump kind of Doge ambit. But maybe someone would go after E-rate. My guess would be if someone is going to do something with it, it could be that the Congress is heading to budget reconciliation. And that seems like the kind of mechanism by which E-rate might be affected, because it's a whole lot of tax and spend kind of stuff that's very in the weeds, and there are going to be a whole lot of things thrown in there. I honestly have no idea how E-rate would sort of measure in their accounting calculus, good, bad, indifferent. But that's probably where it will be affected. I don't think it's something that Trump will necessarily target or Doge will necessarily target, because it's not really exactly a program or an agency. It's not something you can just kind of pin down and say, look, here's the building where all this happens, and it employs all these bureaucrats. So my guess is it's probably safe for now, because it's probably flying under most budget cutters' radars. But if it isn't, that it's probably going to be impacted. If people are paying attention, it'll be part of this budget reconciliation, is my guess. And it has not been one of the major topics of discussion for that. But the main thing they're discussing right now is just, can the Senate and House agree on basically how to do it?
Right. I know the toughest part of this conversation would be to end it. There's so many different aspects of this. But maybe to wrap up, I know in one of the pieces that you wrote, I guess it was last week or the week before, when you were addressing kind of state officials, it was reassuring, actually, a one-pager in terms of, while the department might be going away, some of the elements of it weren't. If we can wrap up a little bit, maybe, do you have a similar message to our readers, our listeners who might be at that district level, who, again, are concerned about the way they manage their buildings, their schools?
So, again, I haven't seen any talk from the administration, now, originally just from Trump or from Musk, but also now Linda McMahon, that suggests there are big cuts to programs coming. And so, and that includes the big pots of money like Title I and IDEA. So if you receive money those ways, I don't anticipate there will be any, or at least not sizable cuts in those. Where we are seeing more cuts, and this has kind of developed just since Trump took office and we've seen DOGE operating, is a lot of targeting of employees. So what could happen is a lot of employees that are at the Department of Education sort of moving money along and administering programs, they may be gone. And it's possible that that will have a negative impact on how quickly things are done or how accurately they're done. So that might be something to look out for. But the worry that a lot of programs and or large funds are going to be zeroed out, I haven't seen anything from the administration that says they want to do that. And they acknowledge that they can't do that without Congress acting. And for Congress to act, except in budget reconciliation, but generally if we're talking about eliminating programs, it's not through budget reconciliation. And then they would need 60 votes in the Senate. There are only 53 Republicans. And I think at least two of those are unlikely to vote for any major cuts. So I just don't think there will be large slashing reductions made in spending that used to be under the Department of Education, but may be under a few other departments going forward.
Well, Neil, once again, I appreciate your time and your insights. I know that you're waist deep into all of this stuff. And I think your words actually couldn't be reassuring to a lot of our audience about that they'll be able to continue to do the work that they do the way they wish to do it. So thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's all we have for this edition of Innovations in Education. Be sure to go to eschoolnews.com for all the latest news, analysis, and other resources you may need during these uncertain times. Once again, thanks for listening.